This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration prepares professionals to address today's most pressing challenges and offers flexible options with part-time and evening classes to support busy adults balancing complex schedules. Inspire change, shape the future at crownschool.uchicago.edu/social work. This WBEZ podcast is supported by The Auditorium, presenting Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater, April 24th through the 26th. Experience the power, passion, and athleticism under the direction of newly appointed Artistic Director Alicia Graf Mack, plus five Chicago premieres showcasing the bold innovation and artistry that have made Alvin a global cultural treasure. Tickets at auditoriumtheater.org.
This is a major development for my area.
A federal judge ordered the Department of Transportation to release $3 billion that the CTA had coming to them.
The 32-year-old died fighting a fire in Rogers Park last week.
It's tough to lose someone on your department. We're like a big family.
Restaurant workers and organizers surrounded Johnson at a ceremonial veto signing.
Chicago's restaurant industry is not shrinking. In fact, it is thriving.
Hey, Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. It's Friday, so it's time to look back and break down the big stories of the week in our weekly news recap. Political arguments continue to swirl after the alleged shooting of a Loyola student in Rogers Park by a Venezuelan migrant. Chicago Public Schools will make interim CEO Macklin King its permanent leader. Plus, spring break travelers saw long lines at O'Hare and Midway, as well as ICE agents deployed there to assist.
Chicago Public Schools will soon have a new permanent CEO.
570 students searching for a new school with less than 3 months in the year.
Prosecutors say Medina came out from behind the lighthouse and shot and killed Gorman.
What she needs is justice, and what he needs is to be held accountable.
What I want for my child is what I want for every single child and every single person in this city. That is to be safe and to live out their purpose without fear.
We'll get into those stories and much more, but let's start today's episode by shining a bright light on our city, kind of like the many mid-century neon signs that you see around town. Block Club Chicago's Mac Lederman joins me now. He's one of our panelists. Good to see you, Mac.
Sasha, thanks for having me.
So neon signs, huh? You're on the neon sign
Love
beat. More of them are disappearing, though, from marquees and awnings and street corners. Tell me what's going on.
So these neon signs, at one point in time, Sasha, before there was a you and me, there were many of these signs just lighting up entire city streets. You look at pictures of old Chicago downtown, you'd see pretty much every business had a neon sign.
Right.
They were our version of streetlights in a different way. But that's gone away and away as time has moved on. These signs used to be seen as kind of a skilled trade, a craft, something that people learned in trade school. And the hub of that craft was actually here right in Chicago. But, you know, as new technologies developed, sign making as an art kind of went wayward. And there were new city laws that were restricting the amount of advertising on streets, the size of these signs for street safety reasons. So a lot of businesses, they stopped making them, and they're making them even less and less now, Sasha, as we pivot toward digital advertising, social media advertising, less of an emphasis on foot traffic. So the signs that we have remaining, and there are about 30 classic neon signs still in Chicago, think the Chicago Theater in Wrigley Field or smaller places like Candlelight Pizza or Fox's Pub in Beverly stretching the city.
Right.
The ones we got are the ones we got left, and there aren't going to be new ones.
That makes me sad. That Chicago Theater one you just mentioned is iconic, of course. But I remember the city council passed an ordinance a couple years ago in Chicago that was intended to preserve these more classic neon signs.
Mm-hmm.
Is that not working?
Yeah, so this is kind of a first-of-its-kind measure to start protecting these signs as public art and ode to our, you know, our history as a city.
Okay.
And that ordinance, it allows for the permits of these signs to stay active even if they have long expired. Obviously, these signs are not in size code. Neon, to the extent it's used in many of these signs, is also not legal, but they can be kind of grandfathered in even if their permits are expired. And that help save the Gracie's Furniture sign in Logan Square. Others that we've been reporting on the last month, several that have been taken down recently, haven't been so lucky. There's, you know, some flaws or some holes in this ordinance preventing, you know, other signs from being saved.
This is so interesting. Why don't we go ahead and jump into our very super packed recap, Mac? Thanks for checking in with me.
Of course.
Also at the table was WTTW Chicago politics reporter Heather Sharon and WBEZ education reporter Sarah Karp. Now, after nearly a year, the Chicago Board of Education is set to move interim chief executive officer Macklin King in as permanent CEO. So Sarah kicked things off with how she's been leading the district so far.
So Mac King took over 10 months ago in June when Pedro Martinez left after being fired. And she was working in the mayor's office when she was tapped to be interim. Before that, she was a principal of two small schools. She was right in the middle of the 2013 school closings, having been a principal of a school that closed and then going to a different school that received kids. So she does have that background. She is a little bit of a surprising choice in that she is not a former superintendent, and she didn't even have any real big positions inside CPS. She was not a network chief, which is like a mid-level manager. She wasn't like a chief education officer or something like that. So in that sense, she's a little surprising.
And she wasn't too strong at the finance piece, right?
Well, it depends who you ask, which is, of course, always the case. But she, this summer, there was a big debate about how Chicago Public Schools was going to balance its budget. It had started the budget season with a $750 million deficit, so there were a lot of questions. She did not want to put borrowing as an option into the budget, whereas the mayor's office and the people who were appointed by the mayor were supportive of putting borrowing in the budget. So she sort of stood up to them after, you know, having come from the mayor's office. However, I will say that she was hired by Lori Lightfoot. She was not hired by Brandon Johnson. So she wasn't like initially one of his people, but
He kept her around.
He kept her around. And you sort of thought that she was, when they brought her in as interim, that she kind of knew the deal. And I guess she didn't really know the deal. So,
well, let's hear from her. You talked with her yesterday. I want to play a little bit of what she had to say about her immediate priorities as CPS CEO.
Sure.
The families want to feel safe. And I think that the safety of students is first and foremost our biggest priority, to ensure that they have, you know, access to this, you know, joyful and rigorous education that we promise. And so with that, I would say it's tied to budgetary challenges that we have in order to maintain safety. And while providing that safety, we're ensuring that students have access to instruction. So I would say balance it between the two, but I do think safety is foremost the biggest challenge that we're facing.
So it seems like she has a handle on what's in front of her.
Right. And I have to say that she was talking about safety in the context of what happened with the federal immigration enforcement this past fall, where that was a lot of pressure on schools to figure out how to help students get to and from school, considering that their parents were very afraid. And there were some instances where parents were picked up, you know, dropping kids off or picking kids up.
Yeah.
So it was a big challenge. And so now she's saying, well, we really need to figure out how to make people feel safe.
And when does this become official? Is it Monday?
No, she doesn't officially become the permanent person until July 1st.
Oh, okay.
So she must have a contract. Her interim contract probably runs out June 30th. So
I see.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, Heather, I'm looking at you because, you know, Mayor Johnson, as Sarah pointed out, I mean, this wasn't his initial person, but he did give his blessing for this hire after this months-long search process. How do you think the hiring of Macklin King reflects on him?
Well, it was a chaotic process, I think is probably the most neutral thing you can say about it. There was a lot of questions about what specifically the mayor's role should be in selecting this next superintendent, because the legislation that created first the partially elected and then fully elected school board was a little bit vague on precisely how this whole thing was supposed to go down.
Yeah.
You know, also, I think that Sarah rightly points out that for somebody who is expected to be sort of the mayor's person at CPD, King demonstrated a significant amount of willingness to sort of, if not outright challenge the mayor, at least sort of push back against what the mayor wanted. And I think that that is, you know, perhaps not a small part of why the board eventually decided to hire her as permanent, because, you know, CPS is going into a whole new era with a fully elected board. And if King is going to sort of be this new elected board's choice, there's no doubt that she needed to sort of signal that she wasn't just going to be there to carry out the mayor's will.
Yeah. Any thoughts, Mac, on this position finally being filled permanently?
Yeah, just generally speaking, when it comes to kind of big three-letter city agencies, CHA, CPS, CTA, a lot of holes in the main leadership or interim leadership. We see, you know, CTA as an interim president since the leading of Dovar Calder, and then we have the situation which Sarah's been reporting about. You know, one of the essential roles of governing, right, is putting the right people around you, something we kind of learn in journalism schools. If you want to cover issues, it's maybe not best to know the main person, but the people around him who are actually in the trenches making the decisions day after day. So kind of just shows maybe just a lack of political power from the mayor to kind of push through people that he would handpick for these positions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, an inability maybe to make decisions. It's just kind of unclear why so many of these positions so deep into his first term as mayor have remained unfilled.
Yeah. In other education news, Sarah, Chicago School Board voted unanimously to end its contract with the financially troubled Aspira Charter Network. What went wrong?
Well, this is a good question.
And what's happening to the kids?
I think a lot went wrong. You know, basically in November, we started reporting that Aspira's CEO said they did not have enough money to make it through the school year, which is sort of a shocking statement because, you know, that's the idea, is that at least you can make it through the school year. And initially, Chicago Public Schools gave the charter network some cash advances. You know, the charter school network said that they were in bad shape because of some budgeting problems. They had lower enrollment than they expected. Mm-hmm. And at charter schools, the budget is very well tied to enrollment. But there's still a lot of questions about that. And so, yeah, they got a little money from CPS. They went on and on. It was sort of unresolved. And then in March, they were like, come April 3rd, we can't pay our teachers. And Chicago Public Schools said, we can't give you any more money because there's a limit in state law as to how much more a charter school can get compared to a traditional school.
So what's happening with the students? And who gets the buildings? I'm curious.
Well, the buildings, that's a big question that we do not know the answer to. Something to investigate, let's put it that way.
But the kids?
The kids, they are spread out among several different schools. I visited one of the schools that got the most kids, which is Schurz High School. And, you know, they're trying to find their way. It's a very bad situation for them. I mean, you have seniors 2 months before they're supposed to graduate coming into a brand new school, trying to get their credits all worked out, and then just trying to figure out, like, how do they, you know, finish the whole idea of getting into college and mm-hmm. paying for college, and, you know, do they go to prom? What kind of prom will it be if you, you know, don't really know people?
That's,
you know,
tough. It's parents, I'm sure, are weighing in. They're I'm sure confused and upset.
Yes, they're confused and they're upset. They don't understand why it took so long. They feel like everybody has let them down. You know, one thing I will say is that some of the parents did tell me that Aspira wasn't really living up to their expectations, in the sense that it didn't have the programs that were promised and didn't have some of the other things that were promised. So they were eventually wanting to look for a new school for their kids, but not, you know, not halfway through the school year.
Now, in other news, a man's been taken into custody and charged in the fatal shooting of Loyola student Sheridan Gorman. The 18-year-old from Yorktown, New York, was tragically shot and killed. This is while she was walking with friends at the pier near Toby Prince Beach, north of the school campus. What do we know about Sheridan, Mac?
Yeah, so Sheridan Gorman was an 18-year-old Loyola freshman, bright smile, very involved in her Christian organization. on campus, and like many college students her age, they went on a late night stroll by the beach over there by their campus around 1:30 a.m. on March 19th. And that's where Gorman encountered a masked gunman, a 25-year-old Venezuelan immigrant named Joseph Medina. A single shot rang out, according to witnesses, and Gorman hit the ground and was pronounced dead at the scene. So a tragic incident that has, you know, captured national attention and has quickly become a political lightning rod in many ways, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a second.
Yeah, I'm curious, has the school responded?
Yeah,
what are they saying?
The school was very quick to mobilize a vigil for Gorman. Hundreds of students went to pay their respects to her the day after her crime. They've increased security around the campus, but you know, a lot of the conversation around this has gone towards politicians and how they have reacted to it.
Yeah,
can I say something? Allegedly, Jose Medina was the masked gunman, and not mm-hmm. he hasn't been convicted yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I will say there is a pretrial detention hearing for Medina happening in about 15 minutes. My colleague Charles Brush is over there.
Okay.
We should have more details about the allegations against him and if he'll remain in jail before his trial.
Yeah. And Heather, I mean, Mac touched there on another hot button issue with this topic here is Medina is a Venezuelan immigrant. Officials are saying that he was in the country illegally. Do we know that to be true?
We don't. There's some reporting that he was one of the migrants that was bused by the governor of Texas to Chicago in 2023. He at least at some point stayed at a city-run shelter not far from where this crime occurred.
Mm-hmm.
And this is sort of, you know, the type of crime that President Trump has said requires him to launch this mass deportation effort because undocumented immigrants are uniquely violent and pose a unique threat to
right.
people in Chicago.
So President Trump's weighing in on this particular case?
Absolutely. And, you know, President Trump yesterday said that, you know, one of his closest aides is really good friends with Sheridan Gorman's father, which has sort of heightened sort of all of the attention around this. It's not clear that, you know, there was any sort of reason for Jose Medina to be deported or detained before this incident. He was arrested for shoplifting and did not appear for that court case.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that is not sort of an indication that somebody is, you know, quote unquote, the worst of the worst.
Right.
And I think it's important to point out that, you know, the Trump administration's Operation Midway Blitz this fall was designed to sort of, you know, find, you know, people that the president thought posed a threat. You know, Jose Medina was still living in Chicago.
Right.
So there are a lot of questions on all sides about sort of how the laws worked and whether there was some sort of, you know, breakdown. Now, we heard from Governor Pritzker, who said that there was problems with sort of how this whole situation went down. He has not been specific. And we heard, you know, the mayor sort of mourn Sheridan Gorman as a father. His son is about her age. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he spoke about it that way. Her family has been very critical of both the governor and the mayor's response to
her
killing.
Saying, please don't wrap our child's name in this political back and forth. Mac, the local alderperson, their office, Maria Haddon,
mm-hmm.
they're receiving blowback and threats related to this killing.
Yeah, so Maria Haddon has closed her office for the remaining of the week after a protest outside related to comments she made in the mere hours after Gorman's shooting. She said that, you know, Gorman was a victim of wrong place, wrong time. And that has behind that those comments were picked up by conservative media.
Mm.
And just the idea that, you know, how did someone like Medina, you know, end up in the country in the first place? So kind of flipping the argument there against Haddon, and that attracted protesters. And Haddon says threats, violent threats from across the country, many coming from out of state. So Haddon has closed her office and declined to comment for our most recent article. So,
It is also sort of important to remember that most Venezuelan immigrants came to the country seeking asylum. And so we don't know if he was in the process of seeking asylum or what sort of status he actually had. And then the other thing to really underscore is all of this attention is going on without him being convicted, without even really hearing the details. you know, it could be somebody else that did this. I mean,
we truly don't know the presumption of innocence.
Right. Yes. And it feels like the politicians have already convicted him.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. Well, as Mac mentioned, Medina's appearing in court this morning around 11:30.
And we'll know more about a potential motive or an alleged motive today.
Right. Mac, today is also the last day of spring break for CPS students. Many families, as we know, are going to be returning from the trips that they might have made this week. What is the latest on lines at the airports, O'Hare, Midway?
So lines that kind of vary across the country. Obviously, TSA workers, as many of us know at this point, are running on almost 3 weeks without paychecks. Six weeks, three paychecks. So call out rates at some airports are stretching higher than 40%, including in Houston. So it's kind of a pick your poison situation. Atlanta, Houston, I hear lines can stretch for 3 hours long plus. I recently flew out of San Juan, Puerto Rico, and I waited in TSA lines for over 2 hours.
Wow.
I received the message that I should arrive for my flight up to 4 hours before departure. So that was a fun thing to get at 9 p.m. the night before your flight.
Yeah.
But Chicago, O'Hare, the lines have been pretty manageable, according to people so far.
So I hear.
Yeah. Early mornings, you know, hit or miss. But for the most part, it seems like most people are getting through TSA in under 30
minutes. It's kind of under control here in Chicago. I mean, Sarah and Heather, any recent travel from you? Or are you hearing things from friends or family?
Well, of course, there was the news breaking overnight that the Senate has agreed to fund TSA without adding money for ICE or Border Patrol, which, of course, was the offer made by Democrats that Republicans had resisted up until this moment. That bill not only has to be signed by President Trump, but it also has to be approved by the House within the sort of the next 24 to 48 hours, I believe. So it's very unclear whether there is a light at the end of the tunnel for these TSA agents. But if that deal sort of falls apart, I think all you're going to see is increasing sort of lines. And there's no evidence that the president's decision to order ICE agents to airports around the nation, including O'Hare, has sort of reduced those wait times in any significant way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, as well, President Trump earlier this week deployed ICE agents, Mac, at the airports across the country. I saw them earlier this week. I was also flying. I traveled last weekend, and I was flying back to Chicago on Monday morning from Phoenix. And I was there at 8 a.m., and ICE agents were already there and unmasked, which was interesting. And they were assisting, and I'm using, for folks who can't see me right now, air quotes.
They were very big air quotes. I can confirm that.
Assisting, meaning they were standing there, you know, holding onto their vests and just like staring at us. So, I mean, what do we know about what their actual job responsibilities are supposed to be? What are they doing?
Yeah, so we were at O'Hare Monday and Tuesday, kind of to check out what they were doing. And we largely saw them, frankly, just doing security work. A lot of them were captured in pictures just staring at their phones or patrolling exits right before baggage claim for arriving passengers. And usually at those exits, there's a couple TSA agents just standing by them. So I guess it makes sense in theory that those agents that would usually be standing there are freed up to help passengers through into their flights, deprocessing.
So no immigration enforcement has been happening at these airports?
Well, there was an immigration enforcement event at San Francisco at their airport that attracted a crowd and a lot of attention. Apparently, that was unrelated to their work of just patrolling the airport. But
interesting.
President Trump, he's kept this threat alive. He's called these airports fertile ground for immigration enforcement, even though that is not their intended purpose of being there. The threat is still there, and I've spoken to people who are just afraid of this kind of climate of fear, this turbocharging the political environment of the airport, a chilling effect preventing people with vulnerable status from flying. So, the occupation of these agents, the presence of these agents, having them in such a prominent place.
Oh, it's intimidating.
Like O'Hare Airport makes a difference.
For sure.
This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration is designed to prepare students to lead in the social sector by combining classroom learning with field education and five focused pathways. The final deadline for the program is April 1st.
Inspire change. Shape the future. At crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork. This WBEZ podcast is supported by The Auditorium, presenting Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater, April 24th through the 26th. Experience the power, passion, and athleticism under the direction of newly appointed artistic director Alicia Graf Mack, plus five Chicago premieres showcasing the bold innovation and artistry that have made Alvin a global cultural treasure. Tickets at auditoriumtheater.org.
CTA has been fighting to unlock $2 billion in federal funding frozen by the Trump administration, and a judge recently granted a temporary restraining order to restore those funds. Mac, why don't you remind us, why was this money paused in the first place?
Yeah, so I've been tracking the story for a long time. Obviously, staple Red Line project, extending it down four stops, 130th Street, just a really big deal as far as community access, kind of the main hallmark prospect of CTA.
Sure.
While they were dealing with a lot of reliability issues, a bright spot for the future for the agency. And the Trump administration, if you want to think all the way back to the main government shutdown, it felt like a million years ago at this point, there were many deep cuts to government programs and grant funding. And one of the things they went after was nearly $3 billion for CTA Red Line extension. And CTA is in a tough spot because this is an agency that heavily relies on federal funding compared to other city agencies. So this money is the bulk of the money needed to complete this project, and it had been kind of signed and promised prior to Trump taking office. So a lot of legal questions around whether they could actually do this or if they were just, you know, picking political fights to make a point. And the point that they were trying to make was that this money, quote unquote, leaned into race-based contracting, so hiring of diverse business owners to help build the project. But for the CTA, it's a real conundrum because part of the agreement when they assigned this funding to begin with was to hire diverse contractors.
Right.
So, you know, they were just doing what they were obligated to as far as receiving the funding in the first place.
That's crazy, right?
Yeah,
they had to promise to hire diverse people. And
then now
they're
getting, you know,
getting dinged for that.
That's
the Red Line extension, I feel like, since the beginning of time, we've been trying to extend the Red Line.
The 1950s.
I mean, my whole youth and childhood. Yeah. Like, wow.
Yeah, we had community activist Cheryl Johnson on the program yesterday talking about this. And she's like, I've been working on this for decades. As you know, she's the daughter of Hazel Johnson. And this has been sort of front and center for especially Southside residents for a very long time. And I mentioned that lawsuit that the CTA filed, Heather, against the federal government for withholding this money. It was filed Friday, and the judge made the ruling Tuesday. Are you surprised at how quickly things changed there?
No. So the way that this sort of legal fight is played out is that the CTA very purposely spent as much money as it had already received from the federal government and was sort of at the point where it was going to have to shut down the work to go to court to say, look, we have exhausted the funding. It is now a critical situation, and asking the judge to take immediate action. This is how these legal fights sort of have worked out.
Right.
And this was, you know, the CTA's strategy on purpose. They could have sued a month ago. They could have sued 2 months ago. They could have sued 3 months ago. But now it was the point where something was actually going to happen,
right,
which sort of makes the case, you know, legally sort of ripe for a judge to issue a temporary restraining order. Mm-hmm. Now, we should say that, of course, the Trump administration could appeal this order. They could sort of seek to continue to withholding the funds.
I believe he's already threatened that.
Yeah. But the issue is that the Trump administration did the same thing with New York. The similar sort of, you know, transit-focused project that was in danger of shutting down. The New York sued, a judge ruled in favor of New York. The Trump administration ultimately released the funding. And I know that CTA is hopeful that that precedent will sort of set the stage for what is going to happen in Chicago.
Mm-hmm. What happens now, Mac? Are we just sort of waiting? I know this restraining order is temporary.
Well, they're going to keep going as they have been, keep going as these threats have loomed. I think it's, you know, a win for the Trump administration, honestly, just dragging the CTA into a legal battle over these funds in the first place, despite them being signed and promise, it only bodes to slow down the project. And this is a project that has a ballooning price tag ever since it started. You know, the price of lumber has gone up exponentially. The price of labor is going up. So
yes.
It's gained billions of dollars just on its way so far. And if it's delayed past the 2030 finish date, you know, that price tag can only grow larger, and on some of that might land in the hands of taxpayers in Chicago. So, you know, just not a great situation for the CTA, the plan for the future.
Heather, this week you reported on another ongoing saga, whether the Chicago Police Department needs to create a new policy allowing officers to investigate ICE agents during these immigration raids. So Mayor Johnson seems to have flip-flopped on the policy.
Well, it's confusing because back at the end of January, the mayor sort of seized the national spotlight by issuing this executive order directing CPD to investigate allegations of misconduct or wrongdoing by ICE agents. And of course, this was just a week or so after the death of Alex Preddy in Minneapolis. Democratic elected officials across the country were under intense pressure to take action and sort of do something to respond to the outrage among people. Mm-hmm. And of course, here in Chicago, you know, Operation Midway Blitz sort of wound down in December. There were fears that once the weather broke, you know, sort of a renewed surge of agents would come to Chicago. And so the meat of this executive order was a directive to CPD to take the next 30 days and develop a policy to figure out how to do this, because it is complicated, because under most circumstances, federal agents discharging their duties in a reasonable manner. And if you can't hear, I put a lot of emphasis on that word reasonable.
Yes, capital R.
Yes, because it means different things to different people, cannot be sort of investigated by state or local law enforcement officials. So I filed a Freedom of Information Act request after that 30-day period had ended, hoping to see that new policy. I was told that it was not releasable because it was still in draft format, which is an exception to the state's sort of open records law. So when the mayor had a news conference this week, I asked him what the holdup was in finalizing that policy. And he told me that actually CPD doesn't need a new policy and that they've always had the ability to investigate federal agents who commit potential misconduct or excessive force. Now, that was a surprise to me. Because you know, this executive order sort of triggered a lot of controversy. State's attorney Eileen O'Neill Burke called it wholly inappropriate before going ahead and issuing a new policy for her office to sort of handle these issues. But if the mayor is correct in that CPD doesn't need a new policy, I think it raises real questions about why there was no investigation of the shooting of Miramar Martinez on October 4th. She was shot 5 times by a Border Patrol agent. She was charged with a felony for impeding that agent. And then all of those charges were dropped after evidence came out that showed that she had done nothing wrong. So if CPD had the ability to investigate that Border Patrol agent, why didn't they?
I hope you get some answers soon.
I do too.
Mac, you've been following the story of fallen Chicago firefighter Michael Altman. For people who missed this story, what happened?
Yeah, Michael Altman is a fourth-generation Chicago firefighter. He had been on the job for roughly 2 years out of Truck 47 in the Edgewater neighborhood. He was responding to a fire last week at a Rogers Park apartment home. That fire is believed to be started by, or alleged to be started by, a 27-year-old man who was squatting in the building. He got into an argument of a couple tenants and set the building ablaze. Altman, while responding to it, fell through the floor into a burning room where the fire originated and suffered third-degree burns on 90% of his body and died the next day. Michael Altman, you know, he is a Mount Greenwood resident. He has a young son and a wife, and his wife was pregnant, and his funeral services were slated
for today, right?
For today, and they were postponed because Michael Altman's wife had entered labor. We hear from other outlets that she had a healthy baby girl.
Oh wow, what a time! Mm-hmm. What a time for that family. What else can you tell us about Altman's service with the fire department and just how he's being remembered?
Yeah, I mean, someone obviously had a very close relationship with his wife Nora. They were inseparable. They met at a Hootie and the Blowfish concert, according to my colleague Jim Lynch, and it had always been, you know, his dream to kind of follow in the family tradition to join the fire department. He had visitation yesterday, which was well attended. My colleague Colin Boyle took, you know, some very emotional pictures of people honoring and, you know, hugging each other. So just a major loss for his community. Over $500,000 has been raised for his family, as well as his growing family. So we wish the best of luck to them.
Sarah, Chicago's tipped workers, they've been seeing an increase in their wages over the past couple of years. But last week, city lawmakers voted to freeze the phase out. What's the very latest there?
So basically, this was the sub-minimum wage, which basically allowed for, you know, waitresses and other people to be paid less than the minimum wage because they are supposed to get tips. And this was on the way to being outlawed, and it was going to just be they get the minimum wage like everyone else. But restaurants have really been, you know, sort of sounding the alarm that this is going to hurt them because, you know, they'll have to pay their workers more and they already have very tight margins. And so the city council passed this sub-minimum wage, and Johnson vetoed it at an event at a restaurant in my neighborhood in Woodlawn, a good Jamaican restaurant. Oh. But anyways, that's besides the point.
You'll have to share the details with me later.
Yes, well, he the whole thing is that he's sort of standing up saying, you know, workers need to be paid the full minimum wage. This is, you know, a good increase for low wage workers. Many of them are, you know, Black and Latina workers, and so he's trying. This has become an issue where he's trying to stand up to the forces that say that, like, we can't increase wages because that will hurt business.
And Heather, again, I'm looking at you here. Anytime I hear the words Mayor Brandon Johnson,
that's
three
me.
Vetoes from
three
this mayor.
Vetoes.
Have we seen this before?
So the last veto before Johnson took office was in 2006 when former Mayor Daley vetoed a measure that would have required big box stores, which were just moving to Chicago, to pay their employees more. And he vetoed it and the city council didn't override it. Now, I spent most of my career believing I would never see a single city veto by a mayor. And
now you've seen
three. Yeah. So I think, it's an interesting sort of going to be an interesting showdown on April 15th when the city council will have an opportunity to override this veto. It passed 30-18. That is four votes short of what the city council would need to override the veto. And, you know, there is a core of about 18 progressive members of the city council who have given no indication that they are willing to override a veto of a measure that they voted against. Also interesting at that event was the presence, I thought, of Alderman Jason Irvin, who left the chamber rather than vote one way or the other on this rollback of the elimination of the subminimum wage. His presence at the veto ceremony indicates to me that he is not looking to override that veto. Without Irvin's vote, I don't know how that maths for opponents of it. And I think you could see them a little bit trying to regroup. They were in Springfield yesterday, pushing through a bill through committee that would basically eliminate the ability of cities like Chicago to sort of make these changes.
Interesting.
So perhaps a little bit of strategy change as they sort of count the votes. But I think this is, you know, an indication of we have a much more independent city council willing to buck the mayor in a way that we've never really seen in recent history. And perhaps an indication that the mayor is a little bit politically weak. However, if you're giving Mayor Johnson an opportunity to hold events in Woodlawn where he gets to say, I am the champion of Black and Latino working women, and I am not going to let these big corporations take money out of their pocket, he relishes that fight. And that is, I think, what he hopes the next mayoral election will be fought on.
Right. I agree with that very much.
Yeah.
That's one thing I was going to say, is that this is, you know, this is a grand moment for him to make this case that he is the person standing up for the working class. And, you know, one caveat to that, though, is that a lot of restaurants are owned by, you know, very small, you know, they're small businesses. You know, they're not with not huge margins. There's a lot of, you know, Black and Latino families that own restaurants that, you know, will probably suffer should they have to pay their workers a full minimum wage. So there is a balance. It's not, you know, not most restaurants aren't like owned by some big conglomeration. I mean, there are some, but not that many.
Right. Yeah. And I think it's important that we talk about the sort of the money involved here. So right now, the minimum wage in Chicago is $16.60 per hour. So the sub minimum wage is less than $13. So the way that it's supposed to work is that if you get less than, you know, $3 an hour in tips, your employer is supposed to make up that difference. So, you know, these restaurants that are saying we can't afford to sort of pay that full minimum wage from the beginning are supposed to be paying that wage ever. And if they're not, they're subject to, you know, investigations and fines. What will happen under the current law, now that Johnson has vetoed this rollback, is that they're supposed to get annual 8% raises every July 1st until July 1st, 2028, when they meet that 100% of the full minimum wage. So it is not, you know, sort of going from $2 an hour to $15 an hour. And of course, this is sort of the fourth and fifth year, of the phase out that was approved back in 2023 as part of a compromise that the Illinois Restaurant Association at least tacitly sort of, you know, agreed to.
It's time to play ball, folks. The 2026 baseball season has officially begun. The Cubs home opener was yesterday. The White Sox home opener is next Thursday. Any baseball fans in the room?
I love baseball.
You're raising your hand. So, so formally, Mac. I pick you.
Okay. What do you want to talk about?
How did our teams do? Did the Sox win yesterday? Did the Cubs win yesterday?
So the Sox and Cubs, bad start to start the season. The White Sox actually opened the season with a first pitch home run, a first at-bat home run, rather. They went on to lose, I think, 14-1 against the Milwaukee Brewers. So all downhill from there. The Cubs also had a rough start. Four loss. Star pitcher Matthew Boyd, I think, gave up six runs for the Cubbies. But that's why they play 161 more, right, Sasha? So
that's right.
Those will be all right. I think prospects for the Cubs look really good this year. They just locked down several players to long-term contracts, including star player, center fielder Pete Cora Armstrong is going to be a Cub for the next 6 years, so that's kind of good vibes heading into the season. The pitching looks improved, new starting pitching.
It's only up from here.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? Right. I love the optimism. I mean, the White Sox can only do better than last season.
Well, we don't know.
They better win the two games I'm going to next month. That's all I got to say. Still got to figure out what dates those are. Yes. Make sure I show up. And the weather for the games was wild. I mean, we had this dramatic drop in temperature from I think, the day before. Some hail. I saw a little bit of hail yesterday. I was running a little bit from my car to my house after I parked.
Fleeing the outdoors.
Yeah, I was, like, grabbing all my things. Grabbed my purse. Shut the door. I ran so fast, I locked the car from inside the house. I was like, no time to stop. But meteorologists kind of told us on In the Loop over the last couple months that it's typical to have these periods of warmer weather in January and February and March. But this year, I just feel like it's been more pronounced.
Yeah, been a real roller coaster. And, you know, anybody who thinks that spring is actually here before Mother's Day in Chicago is just setting themselves up for pain and heartache. So,
yes. And you do not plant flowers in Chicago until at least Mother's Day. Now, my mother, whose birthday is April 29th, tries to tell me that it's okay right after her birthday, but I don't know if that's like a known thing.
It's like, after my birthday, you can finally put away your big coat.
Yes, that's exactly the thing.
Nobody should be putting away their big coat. I'm putting that out there now.
Yeah, I was loud and proud about that right here on the show, and then stupidly went and put away my big coat and got sick last week.
That's disappointing.
I should have known better. And Mac, I guess the players are kind of used to this, right? I'm wondering if you've sat through a baseball game in some extreme weather.
Well, I was just in Puerto Rico sitting in 80-degree weather watching the World Baseball Classic out there, one of the coolest experiences of my life. So I'll probably end up at a White Sox game this week, and I'll just be reminiscing to better times. It would be nice if the start of the baseball season was a bit warmer. I think it's usually sometimes we get lucky, sometimes we're not. This looks like maybe one of the years where we're not so lucky.
This is not a lucky year for sure. And we can't talk about baseball without acknowledging that debate that's raging about whether sports stadiums should be publicly financed. Fill us in, Mac. What are lawmakers in Springfield considering at this point?
So state lawmakers, they're in their seats over there in Springfield, and this is on the table once again. The Arlington Heights project, the Bears are continuing to push for that, this giant destination campus that will be anchored, of course, by the stadium, used for Bears games and potentially major events. Right now, they're looking for property tax certainties around the stadium. Wouldn't that be nice if we had that on our own homes, right? Property tax certainties.
Yeah.
So they're looking for that, and they're putting pressure on the timetable here, Sasha, because they have already advanced legislation even farther along in Indiana for an alternative site, a stadium right across the border there in Indiana. A lot of enthusiasm from Indianans to steal our beloved Chicago Bears. So Pritzker, Governor Pritzker, has said that, you know, he expects the deal sooner rather than later. There's been a lot of big talk around this for a long time, but I do think this wrinkle of the Indiana stadium and it getting closer and closer, the deal on that end of it, could pressure state lawmakers here in our state to really ramp up and finally find some sort of resolution to this.
Yeah, this is a hot topic. We heard from listeners yesterday. They called in during WBEZ's Say More with Mary Dixon and Patrick Smith. I want to play a little bit of what they were saying.
I feel very strongly that the city of Chicago taxpayers are already taxed so high. My taxes just went up $500 a month.
These are billionaire owners who are now looking for tax breaks when they should be spending their portion of taxes to help the communities that they're in.
I think that there's a better way to do it, and I would propose that it be a loan with interest.
I make six figures, but I really can't afford to really enjoy a game because I can't afford the tickets.
I don't think it's advantageous for them to go to Hammond. They know that, and it's a bluff. They're not going to go to. They're not going to be the Hammond Bears.
That was Colleen.
I have to say though, the Arlington Heights Bears doesn't sound that much better to me than the Arlington Bears. And
it all sounds pretty terrible. I want to give a shout out to Colleen from Andersonville, Carlana from Wheaton, and Lori in Downers Grove. Very passionate women. Apparently for the hour yesterday, I mean, they got a lot of calls.
I'm sure.
A lot of women too, especially just really going after, as you heard, the owners, the billionaire owners, as Carlana said there. I mean, but Mac, what are the next steps here?
Well, I'll just say, as much as we make fun of the Hammond Bears, I think unfortunately that threat has really moved the Overton window on this issue. We're far past the point of even talking about the Bears sticking around in Chicago. It seems like the debate now is Arlington versus Hammond. So both a tough pill to swallow, but one might be a little less tougher to swallow than another. So kind of a wait and see where the Bears end up, but it seems like it's not going to be Chicago at this point, given where the conversations currently
are. Let's just decide at this point. Just pick somewhere. The new delivery robots, I got to ask you about these before you go, folks, because they're causing quite a stir. I'm sure you've seen them around town, but I mean, we saw crazily not just one, but two of them this week crashed into bus shelters and shattered them.
Yeah.
Robots gone wild?
Robots gone wild. and what's interesting is that this has really been the year, I think, that these, you know, the number of delivery robots sort of reached a critical mass, that they became sort of inescapable in some Chicago neighborhoods. Now, what's interesting is that this is just a pilot program. So the city council will have to act whether to renew these licenses to let the robots continue roboting, I guess. And there are a lot of people who do not like their presence on the sidewalk. They say it makes it harder for people to get around with strollers or people who use wheelchairs or other sort of, you know, assisted, you know, devices to get around. And I think it's going to be a big controversy once it comes back to the city council.
I bet you they drive dogs nuts.
My
dog hates the little robot that we have, like, that cleans the carpet. And so I bet you if she saw one of those, she'd probably go insane. She'd be like, what the hell is this going?
Before y'all take off, tell me real quick, what is on your radar for next week? What's on your plate, Sarah? What's not on your plate?
Yeah, well, Monday we have the special board meeting where they will vote on Matt King's contract. So that's probably the biggest news going on.
I think so too for you. Yeah. You got your hands full with that one. What about you, Heather?
Well, I mean, there is never a shortage of news coming out of Chicago City Hall, but I will be asking for more information about the, CPD's policy on ICE agents and keeping a close eye on the general cost of police misconduct settlements. I think maybe this is the first time I've been on the show and we haven't talked about it.
That's right.
But the city council will meet April 15th. They have almost exceeded their entire budget double by this time next year, because so I'll be watching to see if that we cross that
threshold.
So
glad you're holding those folks accountable. Mac, what about you?
Well, obviously, I'm looking out to see if a food delivery robot busts another bus shelter.
Top priority.
Yeah, glass. That will be certainly interesting. I'm keeping an eye on just, ICE agents at the airport, whether hostilities will raise or they're really just there to stand by the exits and look at their phones. That'll be interesting. I feel like I'm just reading back into the news as well from coming off a long vacation. So we'll see where things stand.
I'm with you on that. Yeah,
White Sox home opener on Thursday too. I'm sure hopefully there are some excited, hopeful White Sox fans.
Might be the game I'm going to, actually. That's it for the weekly news recap. My thanks to Block Club's Mac Lederman, WTTW's Heather Sharon, and WBEZ's Sarah Karp. Have a great weekend.
You too.
Thank you.
This episode of In the Loop was produced by me, Sienna Greaves, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/in the loop. Thanks for listening.